The agribusiness model, where most of us get our food, not everyone, thankfully, but enormous amount of food comes from the agribusiness model, which is completely dependent on cheap energy, cheap credit, cheap water, and parts manufactured overseas. None of those things are going to be available in the future in anything like the way that they are now. And complex quota arrangements like the Common Agricultural Policy are not likely to survive, which means farmers will get less for what they produce, and that could definitely push them over the edge. Hedging and crop insurance probably won't be there because those depend on functioning credit markets. And farms are often in debt. They're having to borrow money for the seed to plant this year. If they can't borrow money, they may simply not be able to plant anything in a given year. And farms can face foreclosure as well. But that doesn't mean that food has to disappear because, as you are all very well aware, people can do these things for themselves in local areas. But there is a learning curve involved, so I would definitely suggest that everyone starts now, and I'm sure most of you do this anyway, and so I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. But a lot of people think, well, gardening, why would I want to do that? But absolutely, people are going to have to find different ways of doing things. We need to reverse the model that we have had for how things are produced and start producing them locally, as you know. So if you look at global trade and the vulnerabilities of trade, we have a just-in-time economy, which is quite brittle. It doesn't take much of a kick for a problem in one area to cause problems in other areas in a way that could conceivably add up to cascading system failure. We have a world built on comparative advantage, which is to say that you're told, well, everything should be produced in the areas that are the most efficient at producing whatever it might be, and then you trade the results and everybody's better off. It does lead to cheaper goods for a period of time. However, at the cost of producing long and vulnerable supply chains. So, yes, you get things to be cheap for a while, but then maybe you don't have them at all if supplies are disrupted. And if you've outsourced the production of something essential, then that's going to hurt. Unfortunately, Britain has got rid of an awful lot of what actually provided its economy, its subsistence system, in favor of North Sea oil and gas and money chasing its tail in the City of London, and neither of which are going to be there in the future in anything like the way they are now. Money chasing its tail will not be there at all because so much of the credit will implode, and North Sea oil and gas is depleting at double-digit percentages per year. So Britain is going to be in trouble, and people are going to have to do an awful lot for themselves and make do with a lot less than they currently have. Unfortunately, shipping is dependent on letters of credit, and letters of credit are not available during a credit crunch, which means that there's an almost guarantee of supply disruption down the line. The more you can produce here, the less vulnerable you are. What happens in a depression is you get a lot of beggar-thy-neighbor policies, protectionism, trade wars. Countries retaliate against each other when there are import tariffs imposed. So basically, you get an awful lot less trade than you had before. You have to do things locally, again, as you know. This is a proxy for shipping. This is the Baltic Dry Shipping Index. It fell 96% in 2008. That means shippers were not making any money, and things were sitting on the dock in one country, not moving, even although there was perfectly good demand in another country. What was not there was a letter of credit to allow that ship to move. So goods were spoiling. Even in 2008, when there was no problem with money to buy those goods, you simply couldn't get access to credit. And you had an upswing with the rally, but not really very much of one. And the next step will be to go down again as the credit crunch resumes. This is going to hit shipping on the head very hard. This is what happened to trade in the Depression in a short space of time in the 1930s. Import tariffs, trade wars. They were less dependent on trade than we are. It will hurt more when this happens again because we have outsourced the production of so many things to other countries, including some things that we really are not going to want to do without. So a portrait of systemic financial crisis is high interest rates on remaining debt and high taxes, foreclosures, bankruptcies, business failures, and unemployment, bank runs because deposit insurance is not worth the paper it's written on. It's a confidence trick. They don't actually have the money to insure everybody's deposits. They're hoping that by telling you that they do, that you will actually leave your money in the bank and not, then there wouldn't be a problem. However, the minute the market calls their bluff, it will be game over from the point of view of bank deposits. you get asset price collapses and loss of pensions and other entitlements. Problem with asset prices is a lot of them, a lot of these esoteric derivative instruments are not actually being sold at the moment. We're in an extend and pretend phase. So we'll pretend that things are still worth what they were, and as long as no one actually tries to sell them, you can continue that fiction. As soon as you get a price discovery event where somebody does actually sell some of these things, those asset classes are repriced for everyone who owns them, which means that they probably go to about 5 cents on the dollar. So you can get an enormous amount of destruction of virtual wealth in a very, very short space of time. And unfortunately, from the point of view of pensions, pensions have been underfunded for a very long time. Pension funds were typically trying to make up for the fact that they're underfunded by chasing yield without realizing that meant they were chasing risk. And the insiders who sold these particularly risky assets to pension funds called it landfilling toxic waste. So they knew perfectly well what they were doing to your pension fund. And a lot of these funds are going to find that the assets that they own are worth next to nothing. So pensions are extremely vulnerable, unfortunately. In a depression, you get insufficient liquidity to match producers and consumers. As I said, when you take the money out of the system, you have an economic seizure. You can end up with pay-as-you-go essential services or no essential services at all. Being a provider of essential services is an extremely good thing, especially if you can barter that. Now, again, as you know, this is very much the sort of thing that you do. The kind of thing that transitions is aiming at is exactly the kind of recipe for how to deal with these factors. But it's important to be aware of the scope of the problem and the time frame. So that's something that I haven't heard an enormous amount of in the transition movement. They look at peak oil and they look at climate. They tend less to look at finance, and finance has the shortest time scale of all. And as you can see, the effects are huge. And trade wars, unfortunately, can lead to other kinds of conflict. So that's something to be aware of down the line as well. It doesn't have to happen, but it certainly could. It did the last time. This is a portrait of depression. This is Seattle in Washington State. This was called a Hooverville. All the shanty towns like this were called Hoovervilles after President Hoover, who was probably the most qualified person ever elected president of the United States, but he had the misfortune to be elected by landslide in 1928 and to preside over the Depression. There was nothing he could do about it, because once you had excess claims to underlying real wealth produced, it is a Ponzi scheme, it will implode. There's nothing anyone can do to prevent it. All you can do is mitigate the effects, which is what we're trying to look at here. But whoever is in power at the time gets blamed for it, whether they had anything to do with it or not. So I feel very sorry, for instance, for David Cameron and Barack Obama and our Prime Minister Stephen Harper, because they are going to end up carrying the can for this. And I can imagine the next set of these in Seattle will be named after Mr. Obama, which is very unfortunate, I think. So now to step back and look at interactions again between energy and finance. So we looked at what the energy issues were, and we looked at what the financial issues were. Now we're going to put them together and look at the effect of financial crisis on energy supply. Well, basically, you're going to have falling demand, not because people don't want to cook and heat their homes and drive cars, but because they won't have the amount of money that they would need to purchase the amount of energy they used to purchase. So energy demand will be lower, which means prices will fall. Now, affordability will be getting worse, as we said. So falling prices does not mean cheapness. However, prices that fall reduce investment. So those small fields that we are still discovering are not likely to be developed by people who are facing high physical and financial risks in doing so, because the cost of developing these is extremely high. Often they're in very difficult areas. There's a lot of investment, a lot of time, a lot of money that goes into producing these things. If the price is low, people won't bother. And physical risks are things like we're currently seeing in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance. When you go down 5,000 feet through the water and then drill through 30,000 feet worth of rock into a pressurized formation, bad things can happen. And then you end up with a disaster that you can't even begin to mitigate. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if BP ceased to exist at some point over this, because the liabilities they're going to be facing are going to be absolutely staggering. So physical risk is important as well as financial risk in determining what people will do to develop the oil supplies that we do still have. One thing that I think is likely to happen is that OPEC will probably overproduce reserves under circumstances like this, because if prices are falling, then they're going to be dependent on the same amount of money that they had before. They're going to want to try and fill the hole in their budgets. If prices are falling, they'll probably produce more to make up the difference. So you get this initial period of demand collapse where the production is still up here somewhere, aimed at the previous level of demand. Demand has fallen. What you get is that demand collapse leads to supply collapse down the road. So to start with, financial crisis buys you time. It actually means that for a while you appear to be almost swimming in energy because nobody has any money to actually buy it. However, if you're not getting production, you're not getting maintenance because you have no money, and you can have infrastructure targeting as well, then you're not going to have the supply down the road that you would otherwise have had. So it buys you time initially at the cost of making the problem worse in the future. Now, by infrastructure targeting, I'm particularly thinking of places like Saudi Arabia, where half the population's under 15 years old, and there are no jobs for young people, and they're extremely radicalized. They despise their own leadership more than just about anyone else on the face of the earth. The odds of some kind of insurrection in somewhere like Saudi Arabia are extremely high, and it still supplies an awful lot of the oil in the world. So you could get people targeting infrastructure in places like that that could take oil off the market, a substantial amount of oil off the market quite quickly. So that becomes a factor in supply collapse down the line. The problems with shipping would be another aspect of supply problems down the line, where you simply aren't moving goods because you can't get letters of credit. So demand destruction, supply collapse, then you have the appearance of shortage. And when you have shortages, you will get price spikes. You get a lot of volatility when you get shortage, but you get price spikes. It doesn't mean you necessarily move to a permanently high plateau, but you can go into an enormous exaggerated boom and bust dynamic. But when you have the appearance of shortage and you have price spikes, what that tends to lead to is a resource grab. And some countries do that by sending in tanks to other countries. Other countries do it by simply walking in and buying up production in bilateral contracts. That's the Chinese model. So they're buying up, say, the production of whole oil fields in Nigeria, for instance. But whichever way you do it, it takes oil off the global market. And it's on the global market that ordinary people would access oil. So if there's a perception of shortage, what's left can end up being grabbed by various countries' militaries. And you can end up with oil going from, say, $20 a barrel to $500 a barrel in perhaps the space of 5 or 10 years. And that's very, very difficult to adjust to. You really need to move to a much lower energy lifestyle because it's going to be so expensive down the line. So in terms of what you can do about it, and much of this will be familiar to you, especially the next one, but on an individual level, you would want to minimize debt. You would want to reduce dependence on credit. So, for instance, don't use a credit card when you want to buy something. Buy it in cash. You'll buy less because it will hurt when you hand over 20-pound notes in the way that it does not hurt if you hand over a credit card. You want to hold cash and cash equivalents. Cash equivalents are gilts, short-term government debt. You want to be aware of the banking system because the banking system is extremely vulnerable to asset price collapse. If you have a price discovery event that reprices the derivatives market, the banking system will be insolvent essentially overnight. So be very careful with assets held in the bank. Things like equities, real estate, most bonds and commodities are extremely likely to fall. So when I say sell them, what I mean is the price is likely to fall. You may have other reasons for wanting to keep them, especially real estate if you happen to like where you are and have a system that completely works for you even under hard times. But on the whole, you would want to sell these things because they will be worth less. You want to gain some control of the essentials of your own existence, if you possibly can, as you are all too well aware. Food and water and energy, all these things, you need control over it. You need local self-sufficiency, resilient systems, all these wonderful things that you've been discussing here today. All of these things are incredibly essential, and they're essential right now. I'm absolutely trying to convey a sense of urgency here. There is not a lot of time to play with. We're going to start to see effects building up even within the next 6 months. And 2 to 5 years is likely to be the period of the worst deleveraging, I would think, going forward. This is not a lot of time from now. So these systems have to be up and running. They have to be able to start to reach some kind of critical mass. You won't be able to reach everyone in the time available, but if what you can do is provide a model for other people who did not prepare to see how things can be done in difficult times, that is tremendously valuable, and that's very much what transition will be able to deliver. You need to be worth more to your employer than he's paying you on the whole. You want to be really, really good value. You're far more likely to keep your job under those circumstances. If you've done everything on the list and you still have money, you might think about precious metals. However, they're very much a double-edged sword. I generally don't recommend them. However, there are some people for whom the equation is slightly different. If you've already done everything else on the list, you still have money, and you feel you could sit on them for, say, 20 years without having to rely on the value they represent, then they're a good insurance policy. However, most people are absolutely not in that position. It's quite likely precious metal ownership would be banned, as it was in the Depression, which doesn't actually stop you owning it, but it stops you trading it for the kind of things that you might want. The other thing to consider is that if you do try and sell something like this in the shorter term, because most people will actually need cash, if what they have is gold and silver, and they're going to be forced to sell it to raise cash for food and debt servicing and whatever it might be, if you're going to have to sell it over the next 2 to 5 years during that period of deleveraging, the price will be a long way below where it is now, because if everyone's selling at once, you're not going to get the price that probably even the price that you paid for it. You would have been better off hanging on to the cash, because it'll be cash down the line that you actually need. So, for instance, the Gaza Strip became a noted gold exporter a few years ago. They don't produce gold in the Gaza Strip. People got desperate enough to sell their dowries. And you can bet that if enough people were doing that all at once, they probably got an absolute pittance for it. So just because gold is valuable does not mean you will always get a decent price for it. It will, however, hold its value over the long term, has done for thousands of years. You could buy a really good toga in Rome for an ounce of gold. You can buy a really good suit now. In terms of real goods, it won't change that much, but you have to be sure you can sit on it for a long period of time without being forced to sell it into the ultimate buyer's market. And the final point on this slide, again, as you well know, working with others gives you social capital, resilience, and security. It's one of the most important things you can conceivably do.
That's a question. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere the banking system.
Mm-hmm.
What value is cash?
Ah, well, you don't keep your money in the bank. You have to be creative. You don't want to have all of it in creative and locations. That's where gilts come in. So you don't have a phenomenal quantity of cash on hand, but I would definitely suggest you have some, because then you will be able to access it pretty much no matter what happens. But for people who have more money than you would actually ever want to hang on to, then short-term government debt is the next best thing. And we'll get a little bit more into that in a little while. So we're looking at community building. Again, very much as you know. What I'm trying to do with this speaking tour that I'm on, so I've been touring all around the U.S., I'm now touring all around Europe, and I'm visiting about 10 different European countries, I think. I'm trying to turn virtual communities into real ones. The Automatic Earth is about the 8th largest finance site in the world by traffic. So we have a huge virtual community. But virtual communities don't count when push comes to shove. You absolutely need real ones. So I travel around and I stand in rooms like this, and an awful lot of people are then helped to come together. Now, in this case, you would have been here anyway, but most of the time when I go and do a talk, people come together. That's just that one event that's going on. So people then find each other who might otherwise not have been aware of each other's existence, and then they can become the nexus of a real community in the real world that can actually achieve things working together. Community approaches are always stronger, always more resilient. You know, community ownership is a brilliant idea. So local self-sufficiency is incredibly important. You can barter skills if you know people with enough skill bases. You know, and local currencies are incredibly important, and they can be very, very effective. The thing to bear in mind with local currencies, though, is one of the reasons that they work is that the central authorities do not take a cut. Now, what this means, though, is the central authorities will probably come to resent this at some point down the line, especially when they go into tax grab mode. So local currencies can end up getting shut down as they did, for instance, in Austria in the Depression. There was a really successful one that was shut down. If one regards a local currency as a period of borrowed time, in a sense, and say, well, we can do this, and at some point somebody's going to notice, but in the meantime, we can make an enormous difference in our own favor, and regard it with the kind of sense of urgency that gets people really moving, then they can be tremendously effective. The problems are if people assume they're going to last forever and then they don't, if they haven't made the adaptations in that period of time that they had, then that is an opportunity wasted. So I would say definitely you need to be thinking about making all the changes as soon as you possibly can once you actually bring these things into being. For the time being, they're not considered a threat, so they're doing perfectly well. They would be considered a threat far more so if you were in a situation where you were already in a state of depression. So things to bear in mind. Risk will be everywhere in a way that we are just not remotely used to. Other people in other parts of the world are, but we are not. Insurance will not be available because insurance companies are invested in the very assets that will be worth next to nothing going forward. Dependency is vulnerability. The more you are dependent on things, the more vulnerable you are. It's important to face uncertainty with flexibility. How many different ways can you perform an essential function, for instance? I mean, how many different ways could you cook something? What kinds of infrastructure would you have? And there are solar ovens, there are barbecues with propane, there are Coleman stoves with butane, there are wood stoves, there are electric ranges, gas ovens, there are all manner of things. You don't know necessarily what inputs you will have. So the more things that you can do for yourself in different ways, the less you are dependent on any one kind of input. So this kind of flexibility is quite important. Health is essential. In an era when all manner of essential services and centralized services are going to be delivered less effectively than they currently are, things like health, people will have to look after a lot more for themselves. And I'm sure most of the people in this room are totally aware of that. An awful lot of people are not, though, and eat an awful lot of chip butties and don't really do anything. So, but people are going to have to be much, much more responsible for their own health than they have been able to get away with over a very long time. It's important to be aware that dashed collective expectations are dangerous. When people have the rug pulled out from their feet altogether, then they tend to run around like headless chickens. And I think it was Kipling who said that it's important to keep your head while all around you are losing theirs. If you do that, then you are a model for decent behavior. So when people are running around like headless chickens, they can see other systems that are working, and they can calm down and just get on with copying what you're doing already. So being able to be a model for areas that did not get around to preparing is an extremely important role. You can't prepare everyone in advance, but the people who can prepare can play an enormous role as a model. And connections with other people, as you know, are the most important thing. There is nothing you can have that is worth more than relationships of trust. And if you establish them before things get difficult, they will actually strengthen in hard times. If you don't establish them until afterwards, then you have a wall of suspicion to climb because people are afraid and not in a constructive frame of mind necessarily. So building the connections with other people in local areas matters almost more than one can imagine, and doing it now too. So in conclusion, we're looking at a very serious deflationary financial crisis and a second Great Depression. And it will very likely be worse than the last one because all the circumstances that went into forming it are worse. The risk of conflict will be high. And we're moving towards an energy-poor future. First, we're going to look at demand collapse. Then there's supply collapse. It will be an energy-poor future. Probably within the space of 10 years, I would think we would have access to vastly less energy. And we may have access to less energy considerably sooner than that if we simply don't have any money. So we're not going to have the same kind of society or economy that we have had. And for a lot of us, we would say, well, that's on the whole a good thing, because what we've been doing is completely destroying the planet. So we do have to do things differently. It's not that we should be trying to preserve the model we have, that is pathological in the first place, but we are going to have to build something new, something different, very much along the lines of what you're trying to put together here. And finance, energy, and geopolitics will all affect each other, interact in profound and important ways. Big picture stuff is really, really important at this period of time. people are going to have to look at integrating enormous numbers of factors to understand what's actually going on. Too many people are focusing on one thing or another and really not putting each thing they're looking at in context. The context is very, very important, and that is very much what we do, what we will continue to do going forward. Thank you very much.
So as far as context goes in the larger picture, the aspect that Nicole didn't develop in that presentation was the social angle, with a larger and larger proportion of people being dispossessed, with food prices going up and increasing violence being used on a routine basis, then prediction of social discontent and mass unrest are not particularly surprising. And yes, the bank could chase you if you're in debt, but it can't chase everybody. And with the strict father model suggesting that those in debt are the few feeble-minded, morally incapable individuals who deserve to be in debt, that's one thing. But with an ever larger proportion of people finding themselves in debt through actions beyond their control, then it seems to me the legitimacy is likely to crumble, such as it was in people's minds. Relationships certainly are key. People who know you and love you and care about you are not going to vanish the way that paper wealth can if the government so decrees it. And ultimately, even holding precious metals is not what you're looking for in a situation where food is scarce because you can't eat gold. So I'm thinking that as an increasing awareness of the corruption of the system itself and of the people who administer it spreads, then alternatives will arise, alternatives which are locally based, bottom-up, and therefore hard to police and hard to extract taxes out of. Nicole's research has focused on the past, so it's not surprising that she's not thinking so much about emerging systems. Could the fact that so many people are in the same difficult situation give rise to a new internet-based bottom-up system of organizing? Well, watch this space. We're going to close this week's show with a reading of a piece by Michael Hudson called The Language of Looting, which attempts to clarify what's really going on by looking at how language has been changed and its meanings been inverted in an attempt to obfuscate the theft that's really going on. His main point is about free markets, that they were originally intended to mean free from interference by privileged interests, such as kings, landlords, other people whose position of influence allows them to levy taxes, unearned income. Because covering these costs will distort the prices that people charge, and it'll make the system inefficient. Nowadays, when you hear free markets, that's not what it means. That's how it's presented, but what it means is free of any interference in the extraction of these taxes. So, if you're a monopoly and there's laws against monopolies, that's an impingement on freedom. This goes back to the strict father model and the assumption that whatever happens in the market, that's a chance for the strong and the virtuous to prove their fitness by dominating the others, and that therefore they deserve that somehow. So the discussion of should we be sharing the wealth or should we just let the rich have all the riches, which has become the modern left-right paradigm, has changed, because it used to be a discussion about what's the most effective way to share the wealth. Should we be doing it through larger government or should we be having it through smaller government? I've oversimplified this complex article, but I thought that would get you started, because it's not easy to get your head round. Banking shares began to plunge Friday morning after Senator Dodd the Connecticut Democrat, who is chairman of the Banking Committee, said in an interview with the Bloomberg Television that he was concerned the government might end up nationalizing some lenders, at least for a short time. Several other prominent policymakers, including Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Fed, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, have echoed that view recently. That was Eric Dash from the New York Times in February of 2009, and that's the starting point for Michael Hudson's article, The Language of Looting. How is it that Alan Greenspan, free market lobbyist for Wall Street, recently announced that he favored nationalization of America's banks, and indeed, mainly the biggest and most powerful? Has the old disciple of Ayn Rand gone red in the night? Surely not. The answer is that the rhetoric of free markets, nationalization, and even socialism, as in socializing the losses, has been turned into the language of deception to help the financial sector mobilize government power to support its special privileges. Having undermined the economy at large, Wall Street's public relations think tanks are now dismantling the language itself. Exactly what does a free market mean? Is it what the classical economists advocated? A market free from monopoly power, business fraud, political insider dealing, and special privileges for vested interests? A market protected by the rise in public regulation from the Sherman Antitrust Law of 1890 to the Glass-Steagall Act and other New Deal legislation? Or is it a market free for predators to exploit victims, without public regulation or economic policemen? The kind of free-for-all market that the Federal Reserve and the Security and Exchange Commission, SEC, have created over the past decade or so. It seems incredible that people should accept today's neoliberal idea of market freedom in the sense of neutering government watchdogs, Alan Greenspan style, letting Angelo Mozilo at Countrywide, Hank Greenberg at AIG, Bernie Madoff, Citibank, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers loot without hindrance or sanction, plunge the economy into crisis, and then use Treasury bailout money to pay the highest salaries and bonuses in U.S. history. Terms that are the antithesis of free market are also being turned into the opposite of what they have historically meant. Take today's discussions about nationalizing the banks. For over a century, nationalization has meant public takeover of monopolies or other sectors to operate them in the public interest rather than leaving them as special interests. But when neoliberals use the word nationalization, they mean a bailout, a government giveaway to the financial interests. Double think and double talk with regard to nationalizing or socializing the banks and other sectors is a travesty of political and economic discussion from the 17th through the mid-20th centuries. Society's basic grammar of thought, the vocabulary to discuss political and economic topics, is being turned inside out in an effort to ward off discussion of the policy solutions posed by the classical economists and political philosophers that made Western civilization Western. Today's clash of civilization is not merely with the Orient, it is with our own past, with the Enlightenment itself, and its evolution into classical political economy and progressive era social reforms aimed at freeing society from the surviving trammels of European feudalism. What we're seeing is propaganda designed to deceive, to distract attention from economic reality so as to promote the property and financial interests from whose predatory grasp classical economists set out to free the world. This attempt is nothing less than the destruction of the intellectual and moral edifice that took Western civilization 8 centuries to develop, from the 12th century schoolmen discussing just price through 19th and 20th century classical economic value theory. Any idea of socialism from above, in the sense of socializing the risk, is old-fashioned oligarchy, kleptocratic statism from above. Real nationalization occurs when governments act in the public interest to take over private property. The 19th century program to nationalize the land, it was the first plank of the Communist Manifesto, did not mean anything remotely like the government taking over estates, paying off their mortgages at public expense, and giving it back to former landlords free and clear of encumbrances and taxes. It meant taking the land and its rental income into the public domain, leasing it out at a user fee ranging from actual operating costs to a subsidized rate or even freely, as in the case of streets and roads. Nationalizing the banks along these lines would mean the government would supply the nation's credit needs. Treasury would become the source of new money, replacing commercial bank credit. Presumably, this credit would be lent out for economically and socially productive purposes, not merely to inflate asset prices while loading down households and businesses with debt, as has occurred under today's commercial bank lending practices. The fact that today's neoliberals claim to be the historical descendants of Adam Smith makes it necessary to restore a more accurate historical perspective. Their concept of free markets is the antithesis of Smith's. It is the opposite of that the classical political economists, down through John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx, and the progressive era reforms, that sought to create markets free of extractive rentier claims by special interests whose institutional power can be traced back to medieval Europe with its age of military conquest. Economic writers from the 16th through 20th centuries recognized that free markets required government oversight to prevent monopoly pricing and other changes levied by special privilege. By contrast, today's neoliberal ideologues are public relations advocates for vested interests to depict a free market as one free of government regulation, free of antitrust protection, and even of protection against fraud, as evidenced by the SEC's refusal to move against Madoff, Enron, Citibank, and so on. The neoliberal idea of free markets is thus basically that of a bank robber or embezzler, wishing for a world without police, so as to be sufficiently free to siphon off other people's money without constraint. The Chicago boys in Chile realized that markets free for predatory finance and insider privatization could only be imposed at gunpoint. These free marketers closed down every economics department in Chile, every social science department outside of the Catholic University, where the Chicago boys held sway. Operation Condor arrested, exiled, or murdered tens of thousands of academics, intellectuals, labor leaders, and artists. Only by totalitarian control over the academic curriculum and public media, backed by an active secret police and army, could free markets, neoliberal style, be imposed. The resulting privatization at gunpoint became an exercise in what Marx called primitive accumulation, seizure of the public domain by political elites backed by force. It is a free market William the Conqueror or Yeltsin kleptocrat style, with property parceled out to the companions of the political or military leader. All this was just the opposite of the kind of free markets Adam Smith had in mind when he warned that businessmen rarely get together but to plot ways to fix markets to their advantage. This is not a problem that troubled Mr. Greenspan or the editorial writers of the New York Times and Washington Post. There really is no kinship between their neoliberal ideas and those of the enlightened political philosophers. For them, to promote an idea of free markets as ones free for political insiders to pry away at the public domain for themselves is to lower an intellectual iron curtain on the history of economic thought. The classical economists and American progressives envision markets free of economic rent and interest, free of rentier overhead charges and monopoly price gouging, free of land rent, interest paid to bankers and wealthy financial institutions, free of taxes to support an oligarchy. Governments were to base their tax system on collecting the free lunch of economic rent, headed by that of favorable locations supplied by nature and given market value by public investment in transportation and other infrastructure, not by the efforts of the landlords themselves. The argument between progressive-era reformers, socialists, anarchists, and individualists, thus turned on the political strategy of how best to free markets from debt and rent. Where they differed was on the best political means to achieve it, above all, the role of the state. There was broad agreement that the state was controlled by vested interests inherited from feudal Europe's military conquests, and the world that was colonized by European military force. The political question at the turn of the 20th century was whether peaceful democratic reform could overcome the political and even military resistance wielded by the old regime using violence to retain its rights. The ensuing political revolutions were grounded in the Enlightenment, in the legal philosophy of men such as John Locke, political economists such as Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, and Marx. Power was to be used to free markets from the predatory property and financial systems inherited from feudalism. Markets were to be free of privilege and free lunches, so that people would obtain income and wealth only by their own labor and enterprise. And this was the essence of the labor theory of value and its complement, the concept of economic rent as the excess of market price over socially necessary cost value. Although we now know that markets and prices, rent and interest, contractual formalities, and nearly all the elements of economic enterprise originated in the mixed economies of Mesopotamia in the 4th millennium BC and continued throughout the mixed public-private economies of classical antiquity, the discussion was so politically polarized that the idea of a mixed economy with checks and balances received scant attention a century ago. Individualists believed that shrinking central governments would shrink the control mechanism by which the vested interests extracted wealth without work or enterprise of their own. Socialists saw that a strong government was needed to protect society from the attempts of property and finance to use their gains to monopolize economic and political power, both ends of the political spectrum aimed at the same objective, to bring prices down to actual costs of production. The common aim was to maximize economic efficiency so as to pass on the fruits of the industrial and agricultural revolutions to the population at large. This required blocking the rentier class of interlopers from grabbing the public domain and controlling the allocation of resources. Socialists did not believe this could be done without taking the state's political and legal power into their own hands. Marxists believed that a revolution was necessary to reclaim property rent for the public domain and to enable governments to create their own credit rather than borrow at interest from commercial bankers or wealthy bondholders. The aim was not to create a bureaucracy, but to free society from the surviving absentee ownership power of the vested property and financial interests. All this history of economic thought has been as thoroughly expunged from today's academic curriculum as it has from popular discussion. Few people remember the great debate at the turn of the 20th century. Would the world progress fairly quickly from the progressive era reforms to outright socialism, public ownership of basic economic infrastructure, national monopolies, including the banking system and the land itself, and, to Marxists, of industrial capital as well? Or could the liberal reformers of the day, individualists, land taxes, classical economists in the tradition of Mill, the American institutionalists such as Simon Patton, retain capitalism's basic structure and private property ownership? If they could do so, they recognized that it would have to be in the context of regulating markets and introducing progressive taxation of wealth and income. This was the alternative to outright state ownership. Today's extreme free market is a dumbed-down caricature of this position. All sides viewed the government as society's brain, its forward-planning organ. Given the complexity of modern technology, humanity would shape its own evolution. Instead of evolution occurring by primitive accumulation, it could be planned deliberately. Individualists countered that no human planner was sufficiently imaginative to manage the complexity of markets, but endorsed the need to strip away all forms of unearned income, economic rent, and the rise in land prices that Mill called the unearned increment. This involved government regulation to shape markets. A free market was an active political creation and required regulatory vigilance. As public relations advocates for the vested interests and special rentier privilege, today's neoliberal advocates of free markets seek to maximize economic rent, the free lunch of price in excess of cost value, not to free markets from rentier charges. So misleading a pedigree only could be achieved by outright suppression of knowledge of what Locke, Smith, and Mill really wrote. Attempts to regulate free markets and limit monopoly pricing and privilege are conflated with socialism, even with Soviet-style bureaucracy. The aim is to deter the analysis of what a free market really is, a market free of unnecessary costs, monopoly rents, property rents, and financial charges for credit that governments can create freely. Political reform to bring market prices in line with socially necessary cost value was the great economic issue of the 19th century. The labor theory of intrinsic cost value found its counterpart in the theory of economic rent. Land rent, monopoly price gouging, interest, and other returns to special privilege that increased market prices purely by institutional property claims. The discussion goes all the way back to the medieval churchmen defining just price. The doctrine originally was applied to the proper fees that bankers could charge, and later extended to land rent, then to monopolies that governments created, sold off to creditors in an attempt to extricate themselves from debt. Reformists and more radical socialists alike sought to free capitalism of its egregious inequities, above all its legacy from Europe's dark age of military conquest, when invading warlords seized lands and imposed an absentee landlord class to receive the rental income, which was used to finance wars and further land acquisition. As matters turned out, hopes that industrial capitalism could reform itself along progressive lines to purge itself of its legacy from feudalism have come crashing down. World War I hit the global economy like a comet, pushing it into a new trajectory and catalyzing its evolution into an unanticipated form of finance capitalism. It was unanticipated largely because most reformers spent so much effort advocating progressive policies that they neglected what Thorstein Veblen called the vested interests. Their counter-enlightenment is creating a world that would have been deemed a dystopia a century ago, something so pessimistic that no futurist dared depict a world run by venal and corrupt bankers protecting as their prime customers the monopolies, real estate speculators and hedge funds whose economic rent, financial gambling and asset price inflation is turned into a flow of interest in today's rentier economy. Instead of industrial capitalism increasing capital formation, we are seeing finance capitalism strip capital, and instead of the promised world of leisure, we are being drawn into one of debt peonage. The financial sector has redefined democracy by making claims that the Federal Reserve must be independent from the democratically elected representatives in order to act as the bank lobbyist in Washington. This makes the financial sector exempt from the democratic political process, despite the fact that today's economic planning is now centralized in the banking system. The result is a regime of insider dealings and oligarchy, rule by the wealthy few. The economic fallacy at work is that bank credit is a veritable factor of production, an almost physiocratic source of fertility without which growth could not occur. The reality is that the monopoly right to create interest-bearing bank credit is a free transfer from society to a privileged elite. The moral is that when we see a factor of production that has no actual labor cost of production, it's simply an institutional privilege. So, this brings us to the most recent debate about nationalizing or socializing the banks. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, so far been used for the following uses that I think can be truly deemed antisocial, not socialist in any form. By the end of last year, $20 billion was used to pay bonuses and salaries to financial mismanagers, despite the plunge of their banks into negative equity. And to protect their interests, these banks continued to pay lobbying fees to persuade legislators to give them yet more special privileges, while Citibank and other institutions threatened to bring the financial system crashing down by being too big to fail. Over $100 billion of TARP funds was used to make them even bigger. Already teetering banks bought up affiliates that had grown by making irresponsible and outright fraudulent loans. Bank of America brought Angelo Mozzillo's Countrywide Financial and Merrill Lynch, while J.P. Morgan Chase bought Bear Stearns and other big banks bought WaMu and Wachovia. Today's policy is to rescue these giant bank conglomerates by enabling them to earn their way out of debt by selling yet more debt to an already over-indebted U.S. economy. The hope is to reinflate real estate and other asset prices. But do we really want to let banks pay back taxpayers by engaging in yet more predatory financial practices vis-à-vis the economy at large? It threatens to maximize the margin of market price over direct costs of production by building in higher financial charges. This is just the opposite policy from trying to bring prices for housing and infrastructure in line with the technologically necessary costs. Certainly is not a policy to make the U.S. economy more globally competitive. The Treasury's plan to socialize the banks, insurance companies, and other financial institutions is simply to step in and take bad loans off their books, shifting the loss to the public sector. This is the antithesis of true nationalization or socialization of the financial system. The banks and insurance companies quickly got over their initial knee-jerk fear that a government bailout would occur on terms that would wipe out their bad management, along with the stockholders and bondholders who backed this bad management. The Treasury has asserted these mismanagers that socialism for them is a free gift. The primacy of finance over the rest of the economy will be affirmed, leaving management in place and giving stockholders a chance to recover by earning more from the economy at large with yet more tax favoritism. This means yet heavier taxes shifted onto consumers, raising their living costs accordingly. The bulk of wealth under capitalism, as under feudalism, has always come primarily from the public domain, headed by the land and formerly public utilities, capped most recently by the Treasury's debt-creating power. In effect, the Treasury creates a new asset, $12 trillion of Treasury bonds and guarantees, for example, the $5.2 trillion given to Fannie and Freddie. Interest on these bonds is to be paid by new levies on labor, not on property. This is what is supposed to reinflate housing, stock, and bond prices. The money freed from the property and corporate taxes will be available to be capitalized into yet new loans. So, the revenue hitherto paid as business taxes will still be paid, in the form of interest, while the former taxes will still be collected, but from labor. The fiscal-financial burden will thus be doubled. This is not a program to make the economy more competitive or raise living standards for most people. It is a program to polarize the U.S. economy even further between finance, insurance, and real estate, the FIRE sector, at the top, and labor at the bottom. Neoliberal denunciations of public regulation and taxation as socialism is really an attack on classical political economy. The original liberalism, whose idea was to free society from the parasitic legacy of feudalism. A truly socialized treasury policy would be for banks to lend for productive purposes that contribute to real economic growth, not merely to increase overhead and inflate asset prices by enough to extract interest charges. Fiscal policy would aim to minimize rather than maximize the price of home ownership and doing business by basing the tax system on collecting the rent that is now being paid out as interest, shifting the tax burden off wages and profits onto rent and interest was the core of classical political economy in the 18th and 19th centuries, as well as the progressive era and social democratic reform movements in the United States and Europe prior to World War I. But this doctrine and its reform program has been buried by the rhetorical smokescreen organized by financial lobbyists seeking to muddy the ideological waters sufficiently to mute popular opposition to today's power grab by finance capital and monopoly capital. Their alternative to true nationalization and socialization of finance is debt peonage, oligarchy, and neo-feudalism. They called this program Free Markets. That was by Michael Hudson, former Wall Street economist, now a research professor at the University of Zurich.
Lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers. I ride and you're running, makes my guns talk.
Next week we're going to be looking not at returning to the original definitions of capitalism, but at getting outside of the framework of any kind of exchange. We'll be looking at the gift economy. The media used for making this episode are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/508. The show has a mailing list at www.altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep doing all you can.